I'll now open up to you to make contributions, to ask questions or make observations on what you've heard, or from your own perspective, what you may not have heard, and want to get some discussion of from your own point of view. So I'll open up right there.
Chairman, it's been suggested to us this evening that the patient voice is silent, and it's almost as if it was suggested that professionals are putting our own point of view forward, possibly, as one actually said, without regard to what patients say. I happened to be present when Lord Joffe's bill was debated in the House of Lords, and I won't forget the line of peers in wheelchairs, some of them quite disfigured as well as disabled, who represented the feeling of considerable threat as a result of the legislation that was being proposed. And I think that was a voice that we need to bear in mind. Also, professionals in palliative care would say that, wouldn't they? Well, I wonder why. Could it possibly be that it's actually because we listen to what patients say, many of whom, with their illness and disability, find unanticipated qualities of life, even in the face of their disability, and therefore themselves want to be life-affirming? Stephen touched a wee bit on the experience of bereavement, and I think John also highlighted some of the potential pitfalls because of the age qualifications. We all know that teenagers in the formative process have lots of secret thoughts and secret dialogues enhanced nowadays by electronic access and so on. I really wonder if the proposers of this bill have given consideration, I speak as somebody who spends a lot of my time supporting bereaved people, to the consequences of a teenager potentially ending his or her life without any reference to or consultation with his or her nearest or dearest, and bringing his or her life to an end with potentially very detrimental and disabling bereavement effect.
Okay. I'll take a couple of points and then come back to you. I think your hand is up there.
Thank you. I'd just be interested to hear from John and Stephen. One of the aspects that wasn't discussed was the issue of resources, and what I found one of the most chilling aspects of this piece of legislation, and in particular the notes that went along with it, was an acknowledgement by Margot MacDonald that euthanasia or the assisted dying would be cheaper than caring for patients with chronic disability and the terminally ill. Now, to me, that is an enormous worry, because this might be part of the hidden agenda that is behind this legislation. That what we're really talking about is what another philosopher, Baroness Warnock, has told and put forward in the media, that euthanasia might be a solution for caring for the burden of looking after people with dementia. Now, to me, I find this a completely chilling and abhorrent prospect, but I'd be interested to hear from the philosopher and from Stephen your view on that.
The last point, to an extent, we already do ration health care. And so every drug that does not make it to, say, the Scottish Medicines Consortium may well lead to that situation, repugnant though it may be. And so we are in a position where I think we've got to be very careful that we keep our eye on the totality of this and don't just split it up into one thing. Rationing exists, we do that, some people don't get. There's various other points I have thought about as this goes on. We're talking about a tiny minority of people here. In 25 years as a general practitioner, I think I can think of two people who have genuinely wished to end their life and have been unable to do so. Another point, I guess, would be the idea of the need for certainty. Medicine is tragically uncertain. I can think of at least one patient of mine who has killed themselves despite having seen me in the not-too-distant past. So when this happens anyway, I cannot be an exact scientist in what is actually an artistic discipline. So I think we have to be very careful about this concept of marginalising or minimising risk, which I suspect is impossible. Here's another point, but just to finish, I would have to say the thing that I have found most powerful, except for the last 6 months, was that following a conference in Inverness and following a rather distressing morning where a series of renowned people put forward a very vociferous case for not having physician assisted suicide for euthanasia, after lunch, a very quiet and reserved and slightly diffident young artist from Dundee, Dutch of origin, stood up and very quietly and dispassionately spoke about his father's assisted death and his mother's non-assisted death, and how the family and he fully supported both of them in their decision and felt equally proud of both of their decisions. We could have heard it from New York.
Okay, I think I'll come to the speakers to respond to the points that have been made so far. Fairly wide range of issues. John, do you want to have a go at it first?
All of them.
If you want, I mean, if you'd rather not.
No.
I was too
aware of the time. If I respond to all of them, we're going to be all evening. I didn't say just briefly that with this one that the patient voice is silent. I said that there in the literature there's very little about it. What we've got is stories, anecdotes, experiences, clinical judgment, all of that. That's not good enough. We need actually more of the kind that we've got on health professionals. We know what health professionals think. There's been survey after survey. We've got nothing like that as far as the patients are concerned. Resources, yeah. I think that one and the way you've expressed it ties into a number of different issues, I think, which are, I think, need to be disentangled. And I think Baroness Warnock's way of making her point probably didn't help, because it kind of sparked a lot of kind of conspiracy theory type thinking, and there's a lot of that around. And if there was a hidden agenda and so on, I would be as kind of appalled as you. I don't know whether there is a hidden agenda, but it does tie into other things like, for example, okay, are we really saying to a patient who is in this particular situation and wants to take or would want to take advantage of this opportunity if it were legal, are we really going to say to them, sorry, you've got to carry on suffering because until we're actually sure that we've got a fully resourced palliative care service, we can't really do this for you? I mean, unless you're prepared to say that to somebody who's actually in that situation, I think the resource issue is double-edged. And the cheapness thing kind of ties in with the burden. I mean, one hears a lot about people not wanting to be a burden. And for some of the people who talk about that, in my hearing, it's as if not wanting to be a burden is an illegitimate motive. Well, yes, if you've been manipulated into thinking that, yes, it's obviously a problem. But I don't see not wanting to be a burden in itself as being an illegitimate motive. And I think, as I said in my presentation, we really have to beware of saying there are good motives and bad motives, legitimate motives and illegitimate ones, and we're the people who decide which is which. I think you've really got to be careful about that.
Very briefly, I'd be happy to provide the references, but there is some work been done on what the attitudes of people in hospices and palliative care units, what their attitude is to this sort of thing. And I don't have the figures off the top of my head, but broadly, the proportions are similar to those within the general population, that a significant number, maybe even a majority, but actually I can't remember absolutely certainly, would favour in principle the option of assisted dying. However, of that group, only a relatively small proportion would wish that for themselves, and of that group, a substantial number were suffering from clinically treatable depression. So there is a little bit of evidence about what people in palliative care actually do think. There's not a lot, you're right, but there is some, and I certainly know of two or three papers. And as far as cost is concerned, why didn't I not include that? I suppose because in 15 minutes you can't include everything. Yes, it's in the policy memorandum, so it's not in a sense part of the bill. It's perhaps speculative. It is a little bit scary. And the other issue about cost is the speculated £600 to £700 it may cost for a psychiatric assessment, because of the acknowledgement that the system as it is at the moment couldn't actually take the the caseload that might arise from this. So I quite agree the costs are a little bit alarming. I'm not sure how much can be read into it.
Sorry, thanks. You said that you didn't think there would be a slippery slope if this was passed. Do you think that the experience in the Netherlands, where 8% of deaths are now from terminal sedation, is evidence of a slippery slope there?
I know exactly which paper you've read in saying that. That represents a fairly minimal increase, which offset a decline in actual physician-assisted suicide in the Netherlands. I mean, it's an example of what I said earlier about every bit of evidence is contested. That one's been given a particular spin. I mean, you've got to look at a whole much wider range of evidence about what's coming out of the Netherlands to really get a firm grip on the Netherlands experience. But I don't think that one figure, which represents an increase of about 0.5% over 5 years, is actually conclusive in any sense at all.
Yeah. Just a bit to go back to what you've just said about the Netherlands. There's currently a citizens' action group wanting to legalise assisted suicide for all people over 70 in the Netherlands. And they're promoting a change in the legislation to enable that and saying that everyone over 70 feels tired of life should have the right to professional help in ending it. And I think there is definitely an element of slippery slope in that.
It may be a little bit difficult to interpret the figures about deep sedation. And in fact, Clive Seale's paper comments that a significant amount of deep sedation goes on already in the UK. However, it's difficult to interpret just what exactly that means. It's been suggested to me, for instance, by an anaesthetist that a significant number of these people may be sedated as a course of their treatment in ITUs because of serious head injuries or whatever else it might be, sepsis or whatever, and they are sedated as part of the treatment and die in the course of that sedation rather than being deliberately sedated until they die, if you see what I mean by that. So it might be difficult to interpret exactly what deep sedation means, but I too would be a little bit concerned about the significant rise in deep sedation in the Netherlands and the supposed fall in euthanasia and the suggestions that that might be a way of trying to circumvent the regulation.
I could just respond briefly to that point. I have the same excuses, Stephen, about what you can't do in 15 minutes. I think one of the problems is that there isn't just one slippery slope argument. There's a whole family. And, you know, there are different slopes and different ways you can slide down them. I think the point I made earlier on was the slippery slope which most people have expressed most concern about, which is non-voluntary developments, non-voluntary euthanasia specifically. I mean, there's always some non-voluntary euthanasia in effect of some kind because of the kind of decisions that are made when the patient's unable to make a decision himself or herself. But there's no, I mean, as my reading of the evidence, but somebody else will tell you different, is that there's no slippery slope that way in Holland yet. And the group to which you referred is still talking in voluntary terms. This is not a kind of program about, you know, exterminating a certain generation. This is about the conditions and circumstances under which this service might be made available to a wider group of people, but on a purely voluntary basis.
Other points? I know that Stephen's got to rush off. He's got a train to go.
I'm okay at the moment. I'm fine.
I'm going to keep going until he tells me that he needs to go.
Yep. The bill also mentioned that it didn't need to be a doctor or a physician to carry out the act. You talk about the rights of the patient to request assistance to die. But competent people do things all the time that they don't necessarily feel they want to do, but they feel obliged to. I mean, if someone wants assistance to die and chooses someone out with the doctor-clinician situation, what impact does that have on a friend who feels obliged to participate in killing their friend because that's what they want, but really they deep down don't want to do that? What impact is that going to have on them at the time and post bereavement?
that's just me. I take it. I mean, I mean, in some cases, that might have an appalling effect. Yes, I'm not convinced that's any of your business as a clinician. I mean, that's the hard response to that, because there are always going to be emotional relationship problems. You can't solve them all, and you're not in that business.
I'm not asking the question of a clinician, I'm asking the person, as a person in society, the law is supposed to protect vulnerable people.
Me personally, my reaction, I mean, I regret any circumstance in which somebody comes out of a situation in a bad way or feeling responsible, guilty, whatever it is you have in mind, because you're being slightly unspecific about it. But in terms of how that becomes part of a clinical responsibility, I just don't see that. And I think the assumption that a lot of people in palliative care make is that somehow that's our problem, and I don't think it is.
Just to comment on that I don't think anybody in this room, and I don't think even Margaret MacDonald, would expect doctors to work in a sort of moral vacuum. And we do make judgments about things. We cannot do everything that a patient may ask us to do. Some things are wrong, some things are unethical, and some things are indefensible, and we would not do them. And it's not just assisted dying. So we do make value judgments, and indeed a lot of the weight of the bill is on the doctor making value judgments about the patient.
Can I just pose a question in response to that? Because an American physician and with part-time philosopher actually said a few years ago that it doesn't matter what the patient thinks because this is just wrong. Is that something you'd agree with?
I suppose I'd need to know a little bit more of the context. Ask me that again, or tell me a bit more detail.
He said, it doesn't matter what the patients think, this is just wrong. So, you know, my point about we need to know more about what patients think about this is irrelevant, because it's just wrong. End of story. Thank you and good night. Is that something you'd agree with?
Okay. Somebody's put it to me in this way, that the issue actually is more fundamental than all of the sort of practicalities that we can get caught up in this sort of bill. The issue actually is, do we believe that people have a right to end their lives? And I guess some people do and some people don't, and you may come to that decision from a variety of ethical or faith viewpoints. I'm not sure that I do think people have the right to end their own lives, and I certainly am fairly confident that they do not have the right to ask somebody else to do it for them.
That was the first thing. I think tonight I felt that there are two very reasoned speakers talking about this, but I felt slightly on different tacks. I felt our first speaker gave us a very, and perhaps because of background, a philosophical case for why there is an ethical dilemma here that needs to be addressed. And the second, I felt, was much more on the practicalities of a particular bill and how it perhaps needs to be tightened up. And to an extent, I feel that the discussion that's following is also slightly disjointed, because we're looking at two slightly different things. Now, it seems to me that the first one does boil down to a debate between what I think is autonomy, which I must confess I don't quite, and I'm not a philosopher, but I didn't think autonomy was purely about what I want. I felt that in sort of Kant, autonomy was more about an issue about what I feel is the right thing to do, having considered my opinion, my wants, but also those of those around me and the people that it impacts on. Like, if I was on a desert island on my own, I do not have any need for autonomy. It's only if there's somebody else there that I need to start considering that concept. So I'm just slightly worried about the definition of autonomy we heard there. But on one side, I think there's this kind of true issue of autonomy. And the other one I do worry about, which is, I think it's about medical paternalism. And it is very interesting that it is medical people in particular that are so exercised by this matter. And I wonder whether that's because it is about perhaps our involvement as physicians. I mean, perhaps if it was, you know, philosopher-assisted suicide or lawyer-assisted suicide or politician-assisted suicide, we might feel differently about it. But it is quite difficult when these two sort of simultaneous arguments are running without being separated out for me.
I think in many ways you make my point about autonomy. If you're on a desert island, probably you have autonomy. As soon as somebody else is there, you don't.
You need to consider autonomy when there's another person there. Autonomy is purely, I think,
becomes an issue when there is somebody else with you whose needs you need to consider as well as your own.
Okay, thank you. On this issue of autonomy and rights, the discussion is about people having the right to exercise this choice. But to pick up what's just being said, I feel very strongly that if you don't, that many of the other people in the population have the reverse right, the right to live in a society where this doesn't exist. And I feel that's, I would be interested philosophically or ethically whether that's a valid kind of thing, but it feels like just as much of a right the other way round for large sections of society who may feel as strongly as that about it. I don't think it's just a right on one side in the language of rights. Is that a valid thought?
It's a thought I've come across before. I had a discussion of the same kind a month or two back with a palliative care doctor from South Africa, and he made the same, I think effectively the same point, along the lines of, I don't want to live in a society in which this is possible.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So, okay, that's a fair enough position. So what you're saying is that his preference trumps the patient's. Which is fair enough, if that's your position, that's a perfectly legitimate position to take, but I think you've got to recognise that that is the position that you're taking.
I didn't say patient there. I said a member of the society. We have people in society who have
but we're talking about a particular group of patients within this bill, specified in this bill.
Okay.
I'm not challenging your position. I'm saying if that is your position, it's as well to recognise it for what it is, rather than some kind of ethical stance.
I think Ewan made a point earlier that in 25 years of practice, was it two, Ewan?
Two.
Two, yeah. Are we potentially making a law here for the few at the expense of the many? Most of us around the table are, I'd suspect, are connected in some way with a hospice activity. Now, I work in a hospice, and I'd like to think I've got a fairly reasonable relationship with my patients, but I think John made the point that this legislation, he would like to take this to specialist decisions by specialists in palliative care. Now, if this law came in, the law for the few, and the same for me, actually, in about 25 years. I've had two or three people, and that's it. What would the rest of my patients feel? My patients that don't want to do this, my patients that... The overriding symptoms that these patients have, I think, are anxiety and fear. And I think, as in palliative care, we have quite an impact on reducing these symptoms. However, if the majority patients, if you like, were coming to us with inbuilt worries about the fact that we were party to assisted suicide, I think that would irrevocably damage the doctor-patient relationship for these people. So I think the majority would suffer. I'd like to know the speaker's views on that.
Yeah. I'll come to you first, Pat, before we come back to the speaker. If that's okay.
Thanks, Mike. Pat Carraher. I represent a personal view, not the organisations that I work for. I need to say that because I think what I want to say is something to do with age and consent and these sorts of things. And yet I don't want to reduce any of this debate to a question of age. I would have to state my own position, which is as a palliativist, and I'm against physician-assisted suicide. But looking at the bill, I wonder what the politicians, Mike, will think of this, because amongst other things, in Scotland we have a huge debate about consent for different ages. Is it 12? Is it 14? Is it 16? And I said, I don't want to reduce this to a trite argument, but is it 17 you can drive a car? Is it 18 you can have a drink of alcohol? Or is that going up to 21? And I don't need to state the obvious, because this bill proposes 16. And I think terminal illness in teenagers is a very, very hard thing to deal with. Youngsters struggle with it. Parents hugely struggle with it. And I have to say, I don't want to confuse the issue because, you know, I'm not proposing this bill should move to 18 or 21 or 25. I just think it's absolutely amazing that it should choose 16, although I see why it maybe has chosen it. And so I'm not sure it's a question, it's a point.
It's a point I've certainly picked up on, because we're discussing a whole host of issues in the Parliament at the moment about, have we got the right to say to certain groups of people that they should vote at a particular age or not, drink at a particular age or not, and it's all happening at the same time as a bill is being proposed that says you can decide to ask a physician to take your life at 16, and it's all part of that same discussion, so I had picked up on that.
We've discussed this before about age, and I agree that it's very difficult, and one could almost, with tongue in cheek, say to somebody who's feeling life tough at 16, well, if you hang on 5 years, you'll be able to buy a drink and enjoy it. Let me just simply agree with Chris, though, by reading again a sentence from my presentation. Exposure in the course of debilitating and terminal illness to the very influences created by this bill would, I suggest, increase the risk of a vulnerable majority.
I did refer briefly to the age question, I think, in my own presentation. I think there are genuine worries there because, the sense that people at 16 are not yet formed, I suppose. The reason why it's 16 is because it dovetails in with a lot of current legislation. I mean, the Adults with Incapacity Act applies to 16-year-olds up, so it's difficult to know where else you would where you would draw the line. But I agree in general, as I said at the time, that is a worry. The question about damaging doctor-patient relationships was another one. I suppose one has to say it's possible. I mean, the point and the problem with this, again, with this debate, which is pervasive, is that we've actually got no evidence one way or the other. A lot of the things that people will say, that say will happen if legalisation takes place, is pure speculation. Seriously, I mean, there's just nothing to ground it in other than that. We don't have any studies from anywhere that enable us to make inferences about what legalisation causes. There's no before and after studies available from Holland or from Oregon. We will eventually have evidence from Belgium, possibly some of the other American states which are actively... Washington already has it, and temporarily... one of the states beginning with M, it's gone completely. there, at end of December, one of the other American states, the courts there decided that actually we hadn't been looking, but it isn't actually illegal here. There's nothing in precedent or case law that makes it illegal. So eventually we are going to have evidence about what legalisation may or may not bring about. But at the moment, there isn't any. And anybody who makes predictions about what will happen as a consequence of legalisation is basically speculating. And finally... I wanted to put a question back to whoever it was who was talking about providing something for the few at the expense of the many. I wasn't quite clear what you were referring to by the expense of the many bit.
Well, we deal with an awful lot of patients, as I was saying, who are obviously sick, vulnerable, anxious, etc. And we're talking about, I think you were mentioning that specialist palliative care...
Specialist palliative care should be providing expert opinion on these potential assisted suicide cases. If this was passed into law, the general public would get to know that palliative care was providing this, and that would have a great impact on the many patients that we see who we're hoping to have a doctor-patient relationship, which isn't influenced by end-of-life issues, assisted suicide issues. That's the point I was trying to make. I think it's potentially damaging for a large number of people who may not feel at ease to talk to their doctor in those circumstances.
Just before John answers, Stephen has to leave. So I know when John was speaking a couple of minutes ago, two hands went up, and I think the points are going to be directed at him. So if we don't mind, Stephen, can I thank you very much for your contribution tonight? Thanks very much.
Sorry, just before I throw this microphone over here, can I just make another point? I think the government is promoting the Choose Life Assist campaign to drive down suicide in young people in this country. Does this not sit rather uneasily with the proposed bill.
Okay, I'll come over here and then back to you, and I think we might have to start drawing it to a close after that.
Do you not think that before we implement a law as momentous as this, that we need to know what the consequences are likely to be? Should that not be put on hold until we know what the answers are likely to be? Because it's going to be really difficult, surely, to withdraw that once it's already started.
Come over here and we'll take the point that was going to be made.
That was exactly my point, but I would just also just, because there are endless points with this, I would just like to say that I sometimes speculate in the dark moments. This legislation is so ill thought out, it's so wide ranging, that even people who are for it can see reservations. And my dark mind and suspicious mind thinks is this a game that has been played to say, let's try and legislate euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide, let the committee sit, but oh no, we'll drop the euthanasia and we'll end up with physician-assisted suicide as the a concession, and we'll end up with still an appalling situation. And I think what I would like to get across is that many folk in palliative care object for the same reasons to both physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia. It's the totality of that.
Can I have a last go at the point?
The same question that occurred, I mean, thought had occurred to me. I mean, there may be built into this particular draft various concessions that could be made at a later stage, but I don't know how these things work. Perhaps Michael should illuminate us on on that one. Sorry, I'm trying to make sense of my notes. I think, coming to the back again, as I understand it, the point I was making in the presentation was that there seems to be a strong case for saying that palliative care experts should be reviewing the palliative alternatives to whether it's physician-assisted suicide or voluntary active euthanasia. But I wasn't recommending, and the bill doesn't seem to envisage, that people in palliative care generally, certainly not in the hospice world, will actually be responsible for overseeing this or carrying it out. It's not ruled out, but as I understand it, the explanatory notes seem to anticipate that most of this work will be done at general practice level. That doesn't preclude, obviously, palliative care experts having some kind of specialist input. But as far as I understand it, it's not envisaged that this is going to be happening in a wholesale way in hospices, for example. Driving down suicide, is there not an inconsistency with wanting to drive down suicide? I don't see why there is. I mean, the fact that we're using one word in both cases doesn't really actually make it comparable. I mean, we're talking very specifically with this bill or something like it about people in very specific circumstances. And I don't think there's a comparison with a policy about wanting to drive down suicide in the rest of the population. That still seems to me a perfectly consistent position to take. And finally, do we not need the evidence first? I kind of sympathise with that, yeah. I mean, I think you could certainly make a case, and I'm saying that at the moment we don't have evidence about what this is likely to bring about. And we may, if we wait for a while, we may get some. My suspicion is that various political and public pressures might actually overtake that. I mean, we're going to be waiting 20 years for anything that looks like solid evidence on which to base this. I think this is probably going to happen before that. And as a really final point, I think anybody who shares that suspicion with me, whether they're in palliative care or any other healthcare field, I think there's a case for actually trying to anticipate it and getting in there now in terms of trying to shape what kind of legislation ultimately we end up with, whether in Scotland or in the UK. If you're not happy, at least one way of thinking about that is participating in a process and actually ending up with something which is the least bad alternative.
Can I ask a question about legal safeguards? There's mention in the notes that the legislation ensures that provided the specified processes have been properly followed, a person providing end-of-life assistance to a person who has requested it will not be committing an offence. Now, say there are other people involved in this, for example, if there's medication prescribed, there may be an additional person, a pharmacist, who dispenses that, what assurances would they have? They may be told that the processes have been followed, and somebody mentioned, I think it was one of the speakers, that there may need to be a lawyer involved in this. How? What kind of guarantees could they have that the processes had actually been followed, and if they weren't, they would presumably be open to prosecution?
These are details that are in the bill and things that the committee will have to establish. I think there's an opportunity for people to raise those issues with the committee and make sure that the members who are considering the bill include that in the report and that there is consideration. Like I said, I think it's one of the benefits of having the ad hoc committee. The members who are on that are dedicated to look at this issue and nothing else at the moment. They're not being distracted by other work that they're doing. I mean, I've sat on committees where you've had really serious matters brought before you, but you're also in that same meeting debating things which are, you know, almost mundane in comparison, and you have to give the same amount of time to the second as you do to the first. And I think having the ad hoc committee will allow that the members on that looking at the bill to go into the fine detail of just what the implications are in terms of what's being proposed. And as I'm sure that, as Stephen said, the vagueness of some of the suggestions being put forward would have to be queried and interrogated so that we can establish just exactly what she means by what she's putting forward in the bill. And it is one of the considerations that we have. Any time a bill comes forward, people don't like the bills not to be specific enough to understand exactly what's meant by it, because you then don't have the ability to either look at the consequences or indeed consider the unintended consequences of any piece of legislation that's brought forward.
Just to remind everybody that a lot of the points that have been raised can be put in evidence to the committee, and it's probably just to encourage everyone to either as an organisation or as individuals to put your points in evidence by the 12th of May to the committee.
Yeah. Okay, I think we've exhausted the points to put to you. I don't want to put you on the spot anymore, John, because I think your contribution has been very valuable and very thought-provoking, and the contribution that you made. Thanks very much for taking the time to come along this evening and doing that for us. Thank you.